Open in prayer. Our Father and our God, we thank you for this opportunity to come together into your presence to study your word this morning and then to come into your presence to worship you. For you have gathered us from the corners of the earth to worship you, and you have called us by your name and prepared us for worship. Father, you are worthy of our worship, and we thank you for the opportunity to come together as your people this morning and transform our hearts by the and renew our minds this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. So we are in the book of Ruth today, and I don't know if we're out of handouts already. I think we handed out all the ones that I had to hand out. But if you don't have a handout, you can get it online on the church website. The way that thing works is that each of those lessons has been like multiple series. Like I think there were 7 for lesson 2. But all the MP3s for those are stacked on top of each other, so you can listen to them in turn. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's kind of a cool feature that the one of the plugins has. So you can listen to them all one at a time and get 7 hours worth of Exodus. But today we're on the book of Ruth. Does anybody know where the book of Ruth historically falls in terms of in the history of the nation of Israel, where it kind of fits in the plan of redemption?
Plan of redemption?
Well, in terms of the history of redemption, you know, the history of God's people, this is real history, and so, you know, we've got, like, Adam on one end of the spectrum, and then, you know, the Apostle Paul on the other end of the spectrum. And so where is this in, or actually John on the other end of the spectrum in Revelation. So where is this in that? Like what historical events does it come before and after? What period of Israel's history? There's a better way of saying it. Anybody? Bueller? So
it's in the judges.
The judges, that's right. Good job. Very good. So it's during the period of the judges. That's right. One of the things that we know about that is that Ruth is the great grandmother, I believe, of David. And so David was the first king. Does anybody know who the last judge was by any chance? Just piece of trivia. Who was the last judge of Israel? Last judge. Nobody knows. Samuel. Even though he's not in the book of Judges, he was a judge. So that's a piece of trivia you can, because people are flipping back and say, Samson, or something like that. And they know Eli was a judge, and then so was Samuel as well. And so here we have a story. Does anybody want to summarize the contents of the book of Ruth and any of the unifying threads of Revelation that seem to be found there? Anyone? Anybody remember the book of Ruth? It's about a woman named
Ruth.
And there's another woman in this story. What's her name? Naomi. Okay, so what is Naomi and Ruth's story? How are they related to one another? Who's the mother-in-law and who's the daughter-in-law? That's right. Naomi is Ruth's mother-in-law. And where are they at the beginning of the tale? They are in the country of Moab. And they are in Moab because Elimelech, Naomi and their sons leave Bethlehem because of a famine. And so they go to Moab, which in itself is sort of an act of faithlessness. And while they're there, they marry Moabitesses, which is another name for female Moabites. And so they, which, by the way, are you allowed, if you're an Israelite, to marry a Moabite? No. So again, we have another thing that shows sort of a decay of, you know, the law of God. They're marrying Moabite women. And so what happens to their sons, Mahlon and Chilion? they die. And so Naomi and Orpah, by the way, I don't know if you guys know this, but Oprah's named after Orpah, but it was a misspelling. Seriously, that's the story of where her name came from. I think her grandmother or somebody misspelled her name, which isn't necessarily a good name here, because Orpah, though, she clings to Ruth as soon as Naomi says, hey, what good is it coming with me? I can't give you another son to marry. You know, I'm like, you know, if I was able to conceive, by the time he grew up, you'd be way too old to even bear children yourself. And so Orpah ends up saying, all right, and she goes back to her people. But what does Ruth do? Does she say, hey, you know? Yeah, so this is a really amazing story here. And she says, Naomi says to her, see, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. So, you know, I don't know if you realize this, but Naomi essentially identifies herself with Israel's God at this point. This is a statement of faith. It's not as if Naomi, you know, widows in Israel, it wasn't kind of like one of those things where you're like thinking, boy, I'm really going to make it if I hang around this widow in Israel. Here's a young woman that has an opportunity to go back to her own land and marry another man and actually be provided for. There's a reason why in the Old Testament law, it was you were commanded to treat widows and orphans kindly because you didn't really have many economic opportunities. If you weren't part of that, you know, if you didn't have land, if you weren't able to take care, provide for yourself, people lived hand to mouth. And you pretty much almost made enough to feed yourself day by day. And most people eked out an existence, much less widows and orphans who didn't have somebody with strong hands and a strong back to provide for them. So essentially, she's clinging to Naomi here, and she said in one sense in 3:10 to show her hesed, which is the word for loving kindness, the kind of kindness that God shows to His people, and that's the kind of kindness that Ruth shows Naomi. So then she ends up falling her back to her people. And Naomi says, you know, all the people greet her, and she says, don't call me Naomi anymore, but call me Mara, because my life is filled with bitterness, which is, by the way, where we get the name Mary, and it's a very common name. But she wants to be called from then on basically bitter because, you know, there's nothing that will come of good as far as she's concerned. And then, of course, Ruth, in the whole story of Boaz comes about, and we'll kind of unpack that a little bit more as that goes on. And at the end, they live happily ever after. So what are some of the key themes that we can draw out if you want to, if we wanted to see here is, and you guys can kind of jump in here. I know you're excited and want to say things and things like that. So just jump in and raise your hand or even just say things. One of the themes you see here is kindness. We already talked about the kindness that Ruth shows Naomi. We also see kindness in Boaz in chapter 2, verse 20, in his greeting of her. It says, I'm sorry, where is this? And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and dead. Naomi also said to her, this man is a close relative of us, one of our redeemers. Well, what ended up happening is that, remember in the law, or maybe you don't remember, but you probably should read the law and then you would remember this, that the people were commanded to not basically like harvest to the edge of the field so that the widows and other strangers in the land could go and glean the edge of the fields and then not starve to death. And part of that is, you know, we think of the idea of loving your neighbor as being something that's a New Testament ideal, that somehow that wasn't in the Old Covenant, but it was very much was in the old, in the law of God, that strangers were to be treated and treated kindly. And the reminder is that you were once a stranger in Egypt and that you're supposed to love your neighbor, essentially. And so one of the acts of kindness would not be to basically glean the edge of the fields. Well, not only does Boaz not say, hey, go to the edge of the fields, but he allows her to gather the sheaves as the men are doing it with the other people of his household. And he realizes that she's a close relative, and Naomi sees in that a great act of kindness, a very generous act that he's allowing her to take of his harvest to provide for them. So it's going above and beyond the requirement of charity that was normally needed. The other thing too is that there's a when Ruth goes to Boaz, Naomi encourages her to go because there's this idea that he's a close relative. Again, one of the things that the law provided was that we tend to sometimes you have to transport yourself back to understand how important the land was. Moving a boundary marker in the nation of Israel was a capital offense because the land was part of your inheritance. And it foreshadows some of the other things that, you know, in the new covenant, the inheritance is foreshadows essentially salvation and what God provides for us. But if a man was too poor to take care of his stuff, usually what he would have to do is sell himself into slavery until he could kind of earn off, his debt and that sort of thing. In one sense, it was a much better system than today, where we, law breaking, we tend to throw people in jail and then they're not of any use. Whereas in Old Testament Israel, if you committed an offense or you did something, you would be indebted to somebody, and you would have to, you know, basically earn back your keep, so to speak, by the sweat of your brow, rather than just like, I steal something, the guy gets nothing back, and then, you know, now you're just in jail and you're not doing him any good. You see what I'm saying? In fact, the law, the penalty, if you stole something, was not only to return that, but you had to return, in some cases, twice of what you stole. So if you went and tried to steal Graham's car, you would have to, once you were caught, you would have to give him two cars in return. So you see, that's kind of certain things that were like big. Like if you tried to steal his horse, you would have to give him four horses. So there's like things in there. So not only does it prevent you from wanting to do things like that because it's going to cost you more than what you would have gotten out of it, but also let's say now I can't provide two cars for Graham. So then I become his slave for essentially a number of years, and I work off what I was going to steal. And then on the seventh year, you're freed, and on the year of Jubilee, you're freed, so that you can return to your land, and so the land doesn't, you know, end up getting just go to the rich people. You see what I'm saying?
They had a land. What's Jubilee?
Jubilee was once every 50 years. Once every 50 years, all slaves would be freed. Everybody would return to their land and everything else. So all debts would be canceled and you'd start fresh, essentially. And so every 7 years, slaves are freed, but I don't know that the people got their land back. Anyway, the point of this is that the kinsman redeemer, though, in this case, could go in there, and a close relative could go and essentially redeem land for somebody. And there were two things here, actually, that Boaz was showing Ruth kindness. One, he wasn't the closest relative. And the other thing is that he not only was willing to go and try and redeem the land that, what's the name of the guy? Elimelech. It was in probate or whatever you call it. He not only agreed to redeem the land, but then also to marry Ruth. Okay? which is levirate marriage. Remember the idea that if a guy dies before he could give a guy sons, before he could have sons, then the closest relative would marry that person, to marry his wife, so that he could provide offspring for them. But they wouldn't actually technically be his offspring. They'd be the other guy's offspring and inherit that land that they had. So at the end of the story, you see this other guy that's willing, that Boaz is willing to go up and say, hey, I'm willing to redeem this woman and her land, but you're the closest relative, so I'm going to give you the option of doing that. And what does the guy say? He's like, no, because I don't want to imperil my own inheritance. You see, because for him to do that would be essentially not working for himself, but Boaz is now working to restore somebody else's inheritance that technically wouldn't be his. It would belong to somebody else. So he wouldn't be building upon his estate. He would be building upon the deceased's estate, and he's not even the closest relative. You see, so you see there's a great deal of kindness and love being showed not only Naomi, but also this foreign woman who's basically become a Jew. Now, what's...
Hold on a second.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So, when Boaz does this, imperils his inheritance. Does he marry another woman so that he could have male children?
You know, great, you had to ask me that. I think that the first child from that thing would be basically establish that inheritance, and then whatever remaining children potentially would be from that. Though now I'm gonna have to do some research and ask that question. That's a good question. My main point in doing this is that if you think, remember, it's easy for us sometimes to forget that they don't have like the whole scriptures in front of them, right? They're not reading back and saying, cool, all right, this is what's going to happen now. If I marry her, she's going to end up being like the great-grandmother of David, and that's going to be really awesome. I'm going to be remembered for centuries for this act of kindness. No, they could only see, basically, you know, you ever heard that idea, thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path? That idea is a lamp unto my feet is that you can only see the next step in front of you. And it's sort of like you have to continue to walk by faith. It's not like a high beam where you can see years out in front of you with the word and have faith that things are going to work out because you know that everything's going to turn out well. Well, we don't even know the name of this guy who essentially says, I'm not going to redeem this woman. I've got my own problems to worry about. But we do know about Boaz and his kindness. And it's just I just want to point that out because it's an act of kindness, an act of faith that he's willing to do this for somebody else for no gain of his own. You know, and he could have gone the minimum when it talked about the sheaves, right? And he could have gone the minimum when it talked about being kind to Ruth. He could have said, I'm not the closest relative. I don't have any responsibility for her, so I'm not going to do anything for her. And so it's an amazing act of faith and kindness here.
It sounds to me that he treated Ruth that way because of the way that she took care of him.
Yeah, and I think he saw some character qualities in her, and I think there's also some love that's, you know, some covenant. It's a love story too between somebody who says, you know, this is a woman of character essentially, and that's really amazing. It's sort of like almost when Christ is just marvels at the faith of Gentiles in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and says, you know, I haven't even found this faith among the Gentiles. You know, a Roman centurion that says, I understand authority. I understand it's not about, like, you know, your voodoo magic and your cloak and everything else. You don't need to come here and touch anything and defy yourself. I know you have the authority to do this. And everybody else, right, they're like, well, if I can just touch his garment, or if you can just come near me, maybe your power, you know, maybe that little thing, your napkin or something like that, will cause me to be healed and show me something. But he understood, the centurion understood, that Christ had the authority to do that. And so I think that in one sense, Boaz is just marvels at the faith of this woman to be able to cling to and say, this is my God. You know, that's a woman of character right there. And just so you know, there was a way for people to become Jews in the Old Covenant. It wasn't like you were just born into that. You could become a Jew from the nations. And you could make Israel your God and become circumcised and all that other stuff. Now, women, of course, they would confess, and then, you know, she becomes part of the descendant of one of the the ancestors of Christ. I'm sorry. And so we also see a theme in here of redemption, and it's bound up to the kindness that's in this story. The Redeemer, we already talked about this levirate marriage that the husband's brother idea, and then also the redeeming of the land and the redeeming of the property. So it's a pretty cool story. And, you know, the nice thing about redemption here, too, is that as soon as that redemption occurred, Ruth and Naomi's conditions changed radically. You see contrasts in here between the living and the dead in 1:8-2:20. Find and seek and rest, pleasant and bitter, full and empty. And you see last and first kindness. And you see Naomi almost like bitter and despondent at the beginning, and at the end she's holding her grandson on her lap saying, you know, God has done a wonderful thing for me. And it's not as if, you know, again, there were probably plenty of widows in Israel, okay? And God didn't show this kind of grace to everybody. And so we don't understand why God shows grace to some, but when we're the recipients of grace, as Naomi was, it just causes joy, and it's an opportunity for us to marvel that God is able to use things like all the other Moabitesses that ended up, you know, being destroyed or whatever ended up happening to them. Here's one that was redeemed to be in the descent line of Christ. It's pretty cool.
It's interesting about how, you know, you've got Ruth and you've got Rahab, and two women who were of the tribes of Israel in the lineage of Christ.
Yeah, exactly. Like Rahab, in fact, when she's mentioned in, I think, some of the things, it's Rahab the prostitute, you know. And she was in the line of Christ as well. And so we see, you know, one of the things that I like about the scriptures is that they're real history. It's not an ideal idea. You know, other religions have sort of this ideal form of truth that just kind of falls from heaven, like the Quran is supposedly just falls from heaven, and it's all timeless and everything. Of course, if you really know about how it kind of unfolds, there's all sorts of contradictions in there, because there's parts that are revealed when Muhammad has no political power, and it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, we need to get along religiously. And then when he has all the power, it's like, make sure you tax these people, and if they want to be Jews and Christians, then, you know, tax them so that they have to go to the state to be able to do their religion. And all, you know, anyway, but history, or the history of redemption, is an unfolding history, and we see God and how He acts in human events and how He redeems people, and we learn things about the texture of the way He's redeemed things for Abraham. And so the way Abraham understood things isn't the way that we understand things. You know, there's a progression of that revelation, and we need to be careful not to assume that everybody who had that revelation understood the fullness of what God was going to do in history. And we still walk to some extent in anticipation of what's going to happen when Christ returns. We're still, you know, living between, what we've been promised and what we're going to inherit. But God is a God of history, and He comes in human history, and we'll be talking about that today in the exhortation, about how important it was that the Son of God became flesh and dwelt among us. Okay, so let's see. Man, I don't know if we're going to end up soon here because I'm not sure about the rest of these questions. Well, here we go. Can you see in God's blessing to Ruth any fulfillment of his covenant? What was his covenant to Abraham?
To make him a great nation.
And in what else? In you, all the
nations of the world will be blessed.
Exactly. And you know, there's an interesting I tend to, you know, I guess you could interpret this a couple ways. When Isaac blesses Jacob, if you go back and read the blessings that Isaac gives to Jacob, he doesn't give the first blessing correctly. It's sort of like the other nations will serve you and bow down to you, which is not what the blessing was. And then God later actually recapitulates that blessing, which I know I use that term. It means he repeats that blessing to Jacob, and he actually gives him the proper blessing that he'll be a blessing to the nations. You see, the idea is that the covenant was set up so that, you know, Abraham and his seed would be a blessing to the nations and not that others would come and like bow down to them. You see what I'm saying? There's a distinction there. And so here we see God blessing the nations in part. And I think there's a tendency in Old Testament history, and especially at the time of Christ, to see the idea that, like, well, God has really taken care of us and we're special because we're Jews and God really loves us because we're Jews and those stinking Gentiles, you know, those dogs, right? We see this especially in the story of Jonah. It's like, I'm not going to Assyria. It's like, there's no way I'm going to go preach the word to Nineveh, right? That's the Assyrian capital, which these guys were ruthless. You talk about like brutal, wicked people. The Assyrians were kind of like, you think of, I can't remember, there's like a story about a guy, Assyrian literature, just boasting about how he, you know, sort of like the whole Conan, to hear the lamentation of the women and the children, you know? And that's sort of like the Assyrian idea. It's like, that's great, you know, just to be able to kind of, pillage the land and everything else and to impale your enemies and to show your strength, you know, strength by, you know, power through strength and through fear and everything else. And Jonah's told to go preach the gospel to them by God. And he's like, no way. And he basically goes off and, you know, about how he gets swallowed by fish and then he gets spit up on the shore. And then he goes and preaches the word and they're all like, you know, in 3 days, this city will fall. And then everybody repents and he's ticked off about it. He's like, this is why I didn't want you to go. This is why I didn't want to go, because I knew you were a merciful God. You know, but isn't that weird? You know, it's kind of like, because I think we forget sometimes, and I think we could all be like Jonah. We sometimes forget that we're blessed to receive grace from God. And so, you know, why would we want somebody scummy to repent? Because let's just hope they get what they deserve someday. Because, man, I can't stand those kinds of people. Democrats or liberals or whatever it is. Abortionists, you know, whoever it is. Yeah, cowboy fans. There you go. People that like to watch football on Sundays.
I think that's an interesting point. You know, he tells Abraham that he's going to make him a great nation. You're kind of like, okay, Roger, check. Not that makes sense. Okay, that's what a blessing looks like, making me a great nation. But the nations of the world will be blessed by, you know, through you.
Right.
It's kind of like, that's a little unexpected.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to take that blessing and you're going to bless others with it, whereas, you know, our egocentric, selfish way of dealing with things most of the time. So I got the blessing.
Right.
I'm going to be this great nation. You know, and then Jacob crosses his arms and blesses the, you know, doesn't bless his oldest son, he blesses, you know, the next son.
Right.
And it's just over and over again, this repeating of, in my mind, a theme of God blesses in unexpected ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Jesus judges it.